Well, we've already had a rich serving this morning from Karen, and it's just interesting to me to think about our different journeys and the way God works in our stories. You know, the work that I do doesn't come because I first dove in to study and ask these kinds of questions. They come from hitting walls and arriving in places we don't understand and feeling like, where is God when it hurts? And being driven to ask the questions about him. I talked a little bit last night about the struggle that I faced when, you know, as being raised to be a wife and mother, I hit this long stretch. It was a decade of singleness that I didn't see coming, and I didn't know what to make of it, and nobody was giving me any other advice of, you know, what to do to move on with my life, to do something with my life. And I was in that stretch, and my best friend from high school was in a very different place. She had married right after her first or second year of college. And she was in this very difficult time of infertility. And I remember sitting in the living room of her apartment as she wept and despaired of ever giving birth to a child. And sometime later, I mean, this went on for a while, she got pregnant. And she gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. About a year after her baby's birth, she and her husband and another young couple went on a picnic along the banks of the Sandy River in Oregon, where I grew up. And it was a picture-perfect day. They were having a wonderful time, and the two men decided to take the baby and go out in the water to play. And they were having a grand time, and the two women were watching from the area where they were having their picnic. And her husband, who was holding the baby, suddenly stepped into a hole in the riverbank and lost his footing. And to spare the baby from a sudden cold dunking, he pushed the baby toward his friend. And his friend, in the chaos of the moment, didn't see this coming. And her baby, she stood and watched as her baby was swept away in the river. It took 24 hours for rescue workers to recover her baby's body. But I'm here to tell you that my friend never got over the loss of her child. I didn't know it at the time, but both of us were asking hard questions, questions about God. Where was he? You know, is he good? Does he care about me? And I didn't know it, but these are theological questions. Questions about God and his character. The moment the word why crosses your lips, you are doing theology. And it's very interesting because I find a lot of women sort of have an aversion to theology, and sometimes for good reason. I mean, it just can seem like a very heady study. It can seem like a weapon that people use against one another. There are lots of reasons to be alarmed at the thought of doing theology. But I want to take it a step further and say we are theologians. We are created for this. We are created to know God, and theology is the study of God. It's not something any of us can avoid. It's about a relationship. It's about knowing God. It's about something we all need. And I think the word theologian is a word we need to reclaim for ourselves, because that's what we are. As God's image bearers, we are created to know God in deeper and deeper ways as we move through our lives. When I was in seminary, I was in the first class of women at Dallas Seminary, and one of the professors said to me, "There never have been any great women theologians." You know, and that sort of goes along the line of what we heard earlier, you know, that women can't quite rise to the mark here that the men that the men can. And I have to say I was a bit bothered when I heard that. You know, but I have learned over time that I am a theologian and that we are all theologians, and that the question we should be asking is not am I a theologian, but am I a good one? Is my theology true? You know, my theology is whatever I believe about God, and so is yours, whether it's true or not. And I'm here to tell you that when you hit a crisis like my friend hit, that was this sudden, abrupt, tragic loss that devastated her life, or the long, drawn-out kind of thing that I was going through, you know, you're going to lean on your theology, whether it's true or not. And I know for both of us, there were a lot of things we believed about God that weren't true that made it harder for us to go through those struggles. But the statement of my professor and the struggles that I experienced in my own life drove me again to the scripture to look at what the Bible has to say about women and theology. And I discovered that that's how the Bible looks at women. It looks at women in terms of what they know and believe about God and how they live that out in their stories. And I also discovered, and I have gone on record in print to say this, that the first great New Testament theologian was a woman. Ha. And that woman is Mary of Bethany. And as I was listening to Karen's story, thinking also about what I was going to say, I have to say that it is totally maddening to me that we have in our Bibles so many strong, incredible, godly women who are using their voices and making decisions and taking initiatives. And these role models have been taken away from us because their stories are downsized when they are interpreted. And her story has been totally downsized. I mean, I was shocked. You know, she was the one I went to because she's the thinking woman in the Bible, right? She's sitting at the feet of Jesus and he's teaching her, and she should be in the kitchen with her sister doing what women do. And I just thought, if there's a woman theologian in the Bible, it's Mary of Bethany. So I went to her story. But I didn't go to just the story of Mary sitting at the feet of Rabbi Jesus. I went to her whole story because we have three pictures of her in the Bible, three snapshots from her story. And you don't understand what a theologian is if you only see Mary seated at the feet of Rabbi Jesus. It's a very familiar story. I mean, sometimes when I've gone to conferences and said I'm going to talk about Mary of Bethany, I have women say to me, if I'd known you were going to talk about her, I wouldn't have come. Because, you know, we hear the same old about her. But this is a story of a relationship with Jesus. This is a story of a woman in very different stages of development as a theologian. And the first portrait that we have of her is the one that is the most familiar. And this is where she's the rabbi's student. She's sitting at the feet of the rabbi, and she's listening to him teach. And there are other disciples there in the room. I mean, this is not quite as bad as Sharon's 32-guest Christmas dinner, but it was a big deal to have Jesus show up in your home with his 12 disciples, and Martha is faced with the responsibility of feeding this crowd. And her sister has disappeared, you know? I mean, wouldn't you be annoyed? I would be annoyed if that happened to me. And she comes in and she finds her sister seated at the feet of Jesus, and she complains to Jesus. And she says, you know, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? So Jesus gives a response that nobody sees coming. Not even Mary would have seen it coming. But Jesus says to Martha, "My dear Martha, you are so upset over all these details. There is really only one thing worth being concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and I won't take it away from her." The rabbi's student this time is an Azer, and she belongs where she's seated. And she makes knowing Jesus her first priority. It's a serious priority. And you know, when we hear this story, as Americans, as women who go to college, go to graduate school, some women who are teaching as professors in universities and seminaries, you know, this is a yawner for us, isn't it? I mean, what's the big deal here? I mean, we expect to learn, and I've heard about this group that you love to dig in and study scripture. So, you know, this is not a real exciting story for us. So one of the things that we need to remind ourselves of every time we open the Bible is that this is not an American book. It's not a Western book. We are as far away from the world of the Bible as you can possibly get. Being an American in the 21st century is a disadvantage when it comes to studying the Bible. And if we want to know the impact of this story and what Jesus is teaching here, we need to go to the Middle East. Mary lived in the world that is like the world that these little girls live in. I remember after 9/11 hearing to my shock that in Afghanistan, when little girls turned 8 years old, they celebrated by ending their education. They were banned. The Taliban was in charge, and girls couldn't go to school. And I remember hearing a story of a couple who lived in Afghanistan. He was a doctor and she was a teacher. And they wanted to teach girls. They felt like this was an atrocity and that was a terrible thing to waste. And it is a terrible thing to waste. And so they had a school. They worked in a two-story building. Downstairs was a medical clinic. Upstairs was school. And the girls had sewing that they sat on when they studied their books. And if somebody warned that the Taliban was on its way or something was about to happen, they got rid of the books, whipped out the sewing. But they were going to educate those girls. And we all know the story of Malala, who was shot by the Taliban in Pakistan. What an amazing Azer she is. She puts us all to shame. But she's fighting for education for girls because it changes everything when women use their minds and develop their potential. Changes whole cultures when that happens. First century Palestine wasn't radical as life under the Taliban, but there are very strong similarities. A man who was a rabbi and lived at the time of Jesus was quoted as saying, "Women listen, men learn." So there we have Mary seated at the feet of Rabbi Jesus, and Jesus defends her choice to stay there. Question that we face is what was he teaching her? And we hear all kinds of stories as speculation because we're not told what Jesus is saying. You know, we're told that Mary's having her quiet time. You know, that this is a sort of a little devotional message that Jesus is giving her. Okay. You know, so you have to be a bit of a detective to try to figure out what's being said here. You have to look at the other conversations that Jesus had. You know, what was the conversation like when Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well? Or when he talked to Nicodemus? Or when he talked to Martha when their brother died? If you look at conversations that Jesus had with other women and with men, you realize that Jesus isn't known for small talk. You know, he's on a mission. He's always talking theology. And he's the rabbi who embodies the message that he has come to deliver. And his theological mission is to reveal the Father to his followers. In John chapter 1, verse 18, we read, "No one has ever seen God, but his only Son, who is himself God, is near to the Father's heart. He has told us about him." Jesus was the perfect image bearer. He did what none of us have ever done. He perfectly revealed God to us. He's talking about himself, and he's talking about the Father. He's not giving Mary a diluted version, you know, theology for dummies. He's giving her the same deep theology that he taught his male disciples. And she's seated at his feet. This is technical language for being a rabbinical student. This is serious studying that she's doing. It's how Paul describes himself as seated at the feet of Gamaliel. And Jesus was teaching Mary the same deep theology that he taught the men. So I want to know, what was Mary doing? What was she doing as she sat at his feet? And, you know, when we hear stories of this and we see paintings of it, it's like she's like a little sponge. She's just sitting there serenely soaking up all of his words. But when you read what other people did when Jesus talked to him, you know that people, they struggled with what he was saying. You know, there was this horrible dissonance between what they believed and hoped and expected for the Messiah to do and be. And here they are being oppressed by Rome, and they're an occupied nation. And they think the Messiah, and he's saying things that don't make any sense, that create this awful dissonance in their minds. We read in John chapter 6 that some of his followers couldn't stomach it any longer, and they deserted him. Mary was no different. This wasn't any easier for her than it was for anyone else. She was doing the work of a disciple. She's pondering. She's wrestling with what he's saying. She's trying to connect the dots between her hopes as this Israelite woman and the kinds of things that he's saying. It doesn't make sense. But this is where most people spot the theologian in Mary. And it gives us a stunted view of what it means to be a theologian. You know, that a theologian is someone who lives in her head. You know, who knows all those big words and can hold her own in a theological debate. And we have this tendency to divorce theology from life. That's not the teaching of Jesus. Jesus wanted his followers to know him and to know his Father. Not the kind of knowing like your doctor knows you by your medical chart and all that data, but the intimate knowing of a relationship. It's not the kind of knowing that informs the mind or satisfies the curiosity, but it's the kind of knowing that transforms who we are and how we live in this world. It's about a relationship. It's about taking the time to know Jesus, not just wanting everything he has to offer us, but wanting to know and understand him, just like we want to be known and understood. It means wrestling to understand what he's telling us about himself and not excusing ourselves when we don't get it the first time. And learning how to live by the things that we learn from him. Mary's only a beginner here. She's doing the hard work of getting to know Jesus. It's a lifelong journey. You know, when she leaves this conversation, there are going to be enormous aftershocks and lots of wrestling and pondering with what he said. and lots and lots and lots of things that make no sense at all. So I want to ask, why did Jesus defend her? Isn't it interesting that we have this glorious moment in the Bible where this woman who is seated at the feet of the rabbi in a room full of men, and the person who objects to what she's doing is another woman. And Martha is saying that Mary suffers from misplaced priorities. Isn't that ironic? Martha has this big job of feeding this crowd, and she needs help. Remember the culture, okay? Let's look at it, look at this story through the eyes of the culture. Everything that's going on here in this story, if you told it to a young girl in Afghanistan, she'd be blown away by it. She would say, Jesus is sending a very powerful message to and about women in this text. But worlds are being juxtaposed here because we have the women's world and all the traditions that are put before us of the things that are our calling. And this, Mary, seated at the feet of Jesus. And everyone in the room, including Mary, expected Jesus to side with Martha. But he didn't do that. And he's not just being, you know, let's just leave this alone. It's, you know, don't bother her. I mean, he's putting a stake in the ground here. He's not just giving permission or asking Martha to be lenient a little bit. He is defending what Mary is doing. Mary has discovered the one thing that really matters, and I won't take it away from her. You know, when we look at this text and we say, you know, we need to guard ourselves from being so busy like Martha, you know, that we neglect our quiet time with God, or that it's okay for women to pursue deep learning if they're so inclined, or that Jesus calls women to be disciples too, and all of those things are important. Sometimes what we do with this text is just really a travesty. It's the worst thing I can imagine. And that is that we polarize ourselves as women. No, we do that. You know, if you went around the room and said, are you a Mary or a Martha? Would you know the answer to that question? We got to fix this. You know, it's a false notion of what it means to be a theologian. Being a theologian means we're engaged in a relationship with the living God, with the person of Jesus Christ. And it has to do with our heads, our minds. We need to use our minds. They are such gifts that God has given. But it also means it involves the heart and the hands and the feet. Theology isn't theology until it hits the ground where we live every day. We're not being excused at all from pursuing the deep things of God, nor are we being excused from serving others. The Bible doesn't divide women into Marys or Marthas, and the men do this too, where they say there are the men who like books and there are men who like to work with their hands. But the Bible doesn't make that distinction. And in fact, in this passage, the person Jesus is after is Martha. It's not Mary or Martha. It's not thinkers or doers. We are called to be Mary and Martha. That's the way theology works. Changes how we live. Changes our relationships with others. Changes what we see when we look at our world and how important and urgent those needs are. And that we need to be involved in changing the world to be like God wants his world to be. So why did Jesus defend Mary? The simplest answer to that question is that Jesus defended Mary because he knew she needed to be there. She needed to know him. We talked last night about being the image bearer. You can't be God's image bearer if you don't know him. You don't know how to live. You don't know who you are. You don't know what your mission is in this world. If you are disconnected from God, or if you think you know enough, or you don't think you need to know anything, let the pastor know it. Let the seminary professor know it. Jesus is saying, you need to know me. You need to know me. Mary needs to know him. It will inform how she lives, because she's looking at the perfect image bearer, and she needs to be like him. But it's also a huge trust issue. Jesus knows that in a very short time, two deaths will rock these women's world. The death of their brother will be a shattering experience, because Jesus won't come in time to save their brother's life. And then they will witness the arrest and execution of their Lord. And both of those deaths will cast a long, dark shadow over Jesus' character. If they are to survive that experience, they need to know Jesus. We used to live in Florida, and there was, during the time that we lived there, there was a news report where a video camera caught a picture of a little sixth grade girl walking in. It was in a mall, and she walked into the range of the camera, put her hand in the hand of a man who was a complete stranger, and together they walked out of range. Later, they found her body, and she had been brutally murdered by this stranger. As adults, we are always warning children never to trust a stranger. But when we fail to sit at the feet of Rabbi Jesus and get to know our Lord, we aren't taking our own advice. We are putting ourselves in a position of having to trust a stranger. Jesus doesn't want our leap of faith. He wants us to know his character, so that when we see the lights go out or the bottom drop out of our world, and there's nothing we can see that sustains our faith, we'll know his character, and we'll have that for our faith to grasp. Jesus says to Martha, there is really only one thing worth being concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and I won't take it away from her. Jesus knew how to fix dinner. I bet he helped later on. That's the first portrait. But there's a second portrait. And this is the one where Mary is disappointed with Jesus. And this is where we see that a true theologian wrestles and grows deeper in the hard places of life. We heard earlier, these are sacred places. They are sacred places. These are places where God does profoundly deep work in his daughters. And it is a really awful time for Mary. You know, she's just when she's making progress, just when she's starting to know Jesus and understand him better, and her theology is beginning to take shape, and she thinks of him, he's her teacher, and she knows from what she's heard in the community that he's a healer. And she believes and hopes that this is the one they've been waiting for, that he is the Messiah. And above all, she knows that Jesus is their friend. So when her world begins to fall apart and her brother is gravely ill, Jesus is far away, she turns to her theology. And she and her sister send out an urgent theological message. Lord, the one you love is very sick. When we had the experience in this country of 9/11, there were stories that we heard in the aftermath of people fleeing out of these buildings. It was the most incredible thing. There was just this flood of humanity flowing out of those buildings. That was the first thing they thought of when the first plane hit the first tower. It was, how do I get out of here alive? And as there was this flow of humanity, and I heard the story of one woman who had to have physical therapy on her feet because of the pounding they took getting out of the building. She was on 102nd floor. The same time that this was happening, there were all these rescue workers pouring into the building. I'll never understand what those people did. It is reassuring to us to know that if we dial that 911 number, that's the kind of person that will come for us. It's a great thing to know that in our world. But when Mary and Martha reached for the phone and dialed 911 for Jesus, Jesus didn't come. He understood perfectly what was going on. He even talked of death. But he didn't go. He waited where he was for 2 more crucial days. One of my friends was in her office in Orlando with co-workers as the 9/11 crisis was evolving. She was standing next to a male colleague she had witnessed to on a number of occasions before. And when that second tower came down, he turned to her and said, "So much for your God." Mary said it differently. When Jesus finally came, she said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." In our evangelical world, we don't stay here. We move on to the grave of her brother, to the point where Jesus calls Lazarus to come out of the tomb. But we need to stay here in this moment, in this horrible, trying moment. This is where we all end up sooner or later at some place in our stories where we have called out to the God who says he loves us, who calls us his beloved. When we need him most, he doesn't show up. Lord, if you had been here, aren't we all saying that? And Jesus is so surprising when he shows up. I mean, how horrible is this that he's too late? I mean, he's way too late. Lazarus has already been buried. The funeral is over and he is decaying. And Jesus doesn't do anything you would think he would do. I mean, don't you think he would at least offer an explanation? You know, you should have seen the traffic. You know, something. You know, give her something to understand why you didn't show up. And he doesn't explain himself. You know, he doesn't tell her why. We want the whys. We want the pieces just to click neatly into place. God doesn't do that, and he's under no obligation to explain himself to us, and most of the time he doesn't. We're left with unanswered questions. And also, he doesn't scold her. I mean, she collapses weeping and sobbing at his feet, and Jesus doesn't say, you know, "Don't you remember the third point I made in my lecture?" You know, I mean, he doesn't do that to her. And he is the one whose theology is impeccable. And he stands most to be offended by her weeping and crying. And we are offended when other people can't come out of their grief and don't get over their wounds. Jesus doesn't treat her like that. Instead, what he does is absolutely astonish. But Jesus enters into her grief and he weeps with her. He sobs with her. And I want to know, what does Mary learn from all of this? You know, yeah, Lazarus gets raised from the dead, but you know what? This is a fallen, broken world, and the chances are very good that she stood outside that grave and wept another time over the death of her brother. This is not a fairy tale. We don't live in the happily ever after. We've got ourselves so confused with that. And Mary's theology, turns out, is true. He is the Messiah. He is the hope of the world. If we don't have Jesus, we have nothing. We have nothing. He's the fulfillment of every promise and of every longing of the human heart. He is the Messiah. And he's her teacher. He's still teaching her right here. He's still working to help her grow and deepen. When her sister comes to fetch her, she says, "The teacher is here." And Jesus is the healer. He is the cure to all that ails us. But Jesus operates according to his own agenda and by his own timetable. Doesn't march to the beat of our drums. And he is her friend. Never, ever was there a better friend than Jesus. But Jesus doesn't fit into the little box that she has made for him, and he won't fit into your box or mine either. But as she looks at Jesus and she sees and experiences him in this struggle, she learns an important Azer lesson, that the true theologian enters into the sufferings of others. And that brings us to the third portrait of Mary. So we have Mary seated at the feet of Rabbi Jesus. We have Mary struggling to connect the dots when what she's learned about him doesn't fit what she's experiencing in her relationship with him. And he takes her to new levels of trust, new levels of confidence in him, that he knows what he's doing and that what he does is right and good, whether she understands it or it makes any sense to her at all. You know, the story of my friend who lost her baby in the river has a second installment that is still a very painful one for me. When her baby died, she and I had lost touch with each other, and so it was sometime after that I heard about the death of her child. At the time, I was going through a theological meltdown of my own. The death of her baby blew another hole in my theology. I didn't have answers for her. You know, how clever of me to think I would ever have an answer for her. But I didn't know what to say to her. I didn't know how to cope or think about something like this. So when I heard about her baby's death, I didn't go to her. I stayed away. When I finally went, I learned that she was longing for me to come. I never realized till then how important my theology is for others. And the interesting thing about the third portrait of Mary, and this is the one that Miriam read to us so beautifully, is that this is the portrait of Mary that seems to matter the most to Jesus. And it's the one we understand the least. I mean, we don't have categories in our culture for a woman coming into a room full of men. Again, think Middle East. Women wouldn't do that. But think what, you know, what it means for a woman to walk into a room of men like this and to pour something on one of the guests, you know, to anoint him. You know, we just don't relate to that kind of thing at all. And yet Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." The setting is just 6 days before Passover. That Passover will go down in history as the Last Supper. There are men in the room. They're gathered around the table. This is a feast in honor of Jesus. You know, the 12 disciples are there. Lazarus is there. Simon, the host, it's in his home. Doesn't tell us much in terms of details, but we do learn that Martha is serving. She is honored for what she is doing. But it is a festive atmosphere. And Jesus is facing the horror that lies ahead. So there is this great divide between Jesus and his followers. I don't think in the history of the world that there has been a lonelier place on this planet than the place that Jesus occupied at the table that night. He's alone. He's depressed. He's dreading what lies ahead. And his disciples, his male disciples, are in complete denial of what is about to take place. The Azer is a strong ally in the battle for God's kingdom. And this is where Mary shows that this strong ally enters the battle. You know, that night there were many opportunities for her to serve, to have ministry to Jesus. You know, we learned that the disciples get into an uproar over the fact that this is expensive perfume that she has poured out on Jesus. Because what she does, you know, here's this room full of men, and she comes into the room with this jar of alabaster nard, an alabaster jar of nard. And she takes the neck of the jar and she snaps it. And then she pours this ointment on Jesus. And Matthew tells us she poured it on his head. In another account, it said she just poured it all over him. And then she unloosens her hair and wipes the excess off of his feet. It's an extraordinary moment of humility for her as a woman, a daring thing to do in a room full of men. And she had other options. She could have preserved this expensive ointment and sold it and given the money to the poor. It was worth a year's wages. Wow. Or she could have joined Martha in serving the meal. And we are told this was pretty important what Martha was doing. But once again, Mary makes a better choice. I call this portrait Operation Alabaster Jar. The ointment that was in this jar was what ancients used to pour on a corpse to prepare them for burial. It was a fragrance everyone would recognize. It's like when you drive by McDonald's and you get a whiff of, you know, it was familiar. It was an aroma that spoke of death. And yet when the disciples speak up, Jesus says, "Leave her alone." I hear my father when I hear those words. I have three brothers. So I want to look at what Mary is doing. I want to ask the question, what is she doing? What does this mean? And it's really ironic when we look at how the interpretations have played out over time, traditional interpretations, that the words of Judas Iscariot are the ones that managed to stick. The price tag. We end up talking about how much this was worth, this ointment that she poured out on Jesus, and, you know, what a lavish thing it was. And yet just a few days earlier, Jesus is in the temple and he points to his disciples to a widow who is dropping in her last coins into these temple coffers. And, you know, there were wealthy patrons of the temple who would have poured in a whole lot more. And yet to Jesus, what the widow was giving was an enormous gift. She was giving everything. You know, it's as if a price tag would matter to Jesus. I mean, think about it. What are we doing? And then some people say, well, this is an expression of her gratitude and love and devotion for Jesus. And absolutely it was. But, you know, it doesn't make sense with the kind of response Jesus gives to this. I mean, it's like it's over the top. I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told in memory of her. You know, there were other people who anointed Jesus. The women who come after his death were really risking their lives to come in. And Peter says, you know, Lord, we've given everything to follow you. And Jesus didn't argue with him. You know, I don't think any of these are adequate explanations for what's going on. And here's an annoying one. You know, when you read these commentaries, a lot of them are saying that Mary didn't understand her own actions. You know, that she just accidentally blundered into doing something profound. Thank you very much, guys. But Jesus seems to think otherwise about what's happening here. He not only defends what she is doing, he interprets her actions. Jesus says, when she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Wow. Jesus praised her actions and linked them to the gospel. And when you look at what Jesus says about her, you know, we can't understand Mary if we take Mary out of context, if we take Mary out of her own context. You know, this is the same Mary that sat at the feet of Rabbi Jesus and listened. And Mary was a good listener. And she heard Jesus say the same things that he was telling his male disciples. He spoke of the cross. And Mary listened. And Mary learned. And Mary wrestled with his words and his actions. And she learned that Jesus had his own agenda, that he would not be governed by her expectations and opinions. He would not be in that box that she had made for him. She learned in the death of her brother that Jesus is the resurrection and the life. Through her suffering, she learned that no matter what happened, no matter how dark it got or how depressed she felt, the safest course of action was always to trust him. She's a Nazar, after all. And she comes to Jesus armed with her theology. And she follows in his footsteps. She does what she watched him do. And in this silent act of worship, she affirms his death. I don't know what she understood, but at some level, Mary understood what Jesus had said about his mission. And she is the only one of his followers who says yes to the cross. She is the only one who encourages him to obey his Father. You know, even for Jesus, it is not good for the man to be alone. And God has provided an Azer for him in the battle. You know, if she does this oblivious to the significance of her action, it is a terrible act of unbelief to say you are going to die, that your enemies will prevail. But Jesus doesn't see it that way. He says, she has done a beautiful thing to me. And what a moment this is for Jesus. Can you imagine? The message has gotten through to one of his followers. For just a moment in time, his isolation is broken. And there is a soldier standing with him in the battle. If you want to get the power of what Mary is doing, compare her with what Peter did when he was given the same information. Remember what he said, never, Lord, this will never happen to you. On the dark side of the cross, Mary believed and embraced the message that Jesus brought and stood with him in the battle. Do you see why I call her the first great New Testament theologian? I mean, how important is a woman's theology after all? How important is it for the Azer to step out and act when she sees the need? What would that evening have been like for Jesus if Mary had never sat at his feet and listened? If she had never wrestled with her beliefs about him in the dark, dark time when her brother died? What if she had held back and restrained herself? You know, I'm a woman and it's really not my place to do anything. Especially look at all the men who are here. You know, I'll just pray for one of them to do this. What would Jesus have missed? I mean, seriously. So let me wrap up with some concluding words for Azers. First, we need to equip ourselves for life. We need to know the God who created us. We need to study Jesus, not just to gather information, but to understand who he is and how he lived, and to enter into the story with him and to emulate what we see. You know, Mary's theology evolved because she saw that a true theologian enters into the struggles of others. Not with a bunch of platitudes or explanations, but just to be there with them in the struggle. We need to equip ourselves for life by knowing God. It changes everything. It grounds us in our identity and purpose. It gives us meaning that endures. It makes a difference in our stories when life and beliefs collide. It doesn't mean we won't struggle. It doesn't mean we won't suffer. It doesn't mean we won't ask those hard questions. But it means our faith will have more to cling to when the lights go out. It means we have kingdom responsibilities. We have responsibility to know theology because other women need us. Children need us, but also the men need us. This isn't about who's in charge or who has the title. It's about being a Christian in this world where there are hurting people all around us. It's about being God's image bearer and an Azer warrior wherever God stations us. We need good theology for other women. We need good theology for men, but for children, but we also need good theology for men. When you look at the story, I'm going to say what I see. We have Mary of Bethany offering pastoral ministry to Jesus in a room full of men. And Jesus says, "She has done a beautiful thing to me." My father was very conservative. If you want to know about gender roles and what women can and can't do, he'd give you the answer. But when he was in a very difficult time in his ministry, an elderly woman showed up at our church. She was a missionary. She was in her 80s. She was in poor health. And by the look of her, she was going to be a lot of work for the church. And she was. But we had no clue of the gifts that God was giving to us when she walked through those doors. And she got under the burden with my father. And she ministered to him in a way that nobody else did. And he said in a public forum, "This woman pastored the pastor." If Jesus valued the spiritual ministry of a woman to himself, who is beyond the scope of your ministry? Who can you look at and say, you know, I'm not up to this, or I'm not qualified, or somebody ring the pastor, you know? I mean, a lot of times, most of the time when I'm hurting, the person nearby is not my pastor. It's somebody else. somebody who looks just like you. And if that person hasn't been about the business of knowing God in deep ways, they can't engage that struggle with me. They can't let me struggle. They're going to try to fix me. If the pastoral ministries of the church rest on the shoulders of a few, there aren't enough pastors to go around. And we can reach places that the pastors can't reach because we also have the Martha bone in us. And we get there sometimes before anybody else does. Let me end with the words of J.I. Packer. Please ponder these things. Think seriously about yourself and what you need to do. In his wonderful book, Knowing God, J.I. Packer writes, "We are cruel to ourselves if we try to live in this world without knowing about the God whose world it is and who runs it. The world becomes a strange, mad, painful place, and life in it a disappointing and unpleasant business for those who do not know about God. Disregard the study of God and you sentence yourself to stumble and blunder through life, blindfold, as it were, with no sense of direction and no understanding of what surrounds you. This way, you can waste your life and lose your soul." May God help us to take him seriously, to get busy about the business of sitting at the feet of Rabbi Jesus and of opening our eyes and looking around us at the opportunities that we have to minister to others. Thank you.